From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is making some significant changes to his economic policy. He now says that China is not a currency manipulator. He now supports the Export-Import Bank. And he even says he may reappoint Janet Yellen as chair of the Federal Reserve. For more on why and what all this means for Trump's economic policy, we're joined by John Idsty, NPR economics correspondent. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And lots to go through here, but let's start with China. During the campaign and until just days ago, Trump had been accusing China of manipulating its currency. Here he is during the campaign.
I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator, the greatest in the world.
But then yesterday, Trump told the Wall Street Journal that he changed his mind, that China isn't currently manipulating its currency. What's going on?
Well, Jeremy, I think the proximate reason for the shift is that at the end of this week, a report is due from the Treasury Department listing countries that are manipulating their currencies to boost exports. The broad consensus is that China hasn't been manipulating its currency for at least several years. And while it did so in the past, China actually more recently has been supporting its currency at higher levels. So if the president hadn't changed his rhetoric, he would likely have been in conflict with the findings of his own Treasury Department. So he changed his view to reflect the facts and avoid that.
And now is in conflict with what he has been saying for a long time, I guess.
Exactly.
So Trump also seems to be changing his mind about the possibility of reappointing Fed Chair Janet Yellen. Here he is on CNBC, again during the campaign, responding to a question about Yellen.
Well, I have nothing against Janet Yellen whatsoever. I think she's been doing her job, and I have absolutely nothing against her. I don't know her. She's a very capable person. She has, you know, people that I know have high regard for her. But she's not a Republican. She's not a, you know, person that, you know, when her time is up, I would most likely replace her because of the fact that I think it would be appropriate.
And he has also made comments about how the Fed is being too political in what it's been doing, and that it was keeping interest rates artificially low during the Obama presidency to juice the economy. But in an interview with The Wall Street Journal this week, again, he said Yellen is not necessarily, quote, toast when her term is up in 2018.
Yeah, you're right. During the campaign, he criticized Yellen for boosting or holding rates low to boost the Obama economy. He actually called her actions at the Fed shameful. Now he says he likes low interest rate policy, which could help keep the Trump economy growing faster. It's hard to predict what this president will do. The Fed is likely to raise interest rates several times before Yellen's term is up next February. He may decide he doesn't like that. But at this point, I guess I'd still be surprised if he reappoints her.
Now, in that same interview with the Journal, Trump also said he thinks the dollar is getting too strong, which is an unusual comment for a U.S. president to make.
Yeah, it's true. Since Bill Clinton's presidency, the official policy of U.S. administrations was that they supported a stronger dollar. Now, that wasn't always good for U.S. exports, but the view has been that if presidents start talking about the direction they want the dollar to go, it could destabilize the financial markets. The dollar did decline a bit yesterday in the markets after Trump's remarks, but the market certainly didn't tank. So we'll see. Maybe his comments will put downward pressure on the dollar over the long term, or maybe it doesn't matter if presidents talk about the dollar.
Hmm. John, another big shift this week is that the president is now saying he does not want to eliminate the Export-Import Bank, which is a bank that finances and insures international companies that want to buy American products. As a candidate, he had said repeatedly that the bank was unnecessary and that it wasn't free enterprise. Now he's changed his mind. Do we know why?
Well, you know, as a populist during the campaign, Trump was basically calling it corporate welfare, the bank, which is in line with the view of many Republicans in Congress, some Democrats too. But it appears Trump has heard from multiple CEOs. He's been talking to a lot of them, including companies like Boeing, and hearing that the bank helps American companies export. And Trump said in his comments yesterday that it actually helps some smaller companies too. So I guess he's just changed his mind.
Why so many shifts in economic policy going on right now? Some people have pointed to Trump's advisor, Gary Cohn, who came from Goldman Sachs, as kind of a big influence on him right now economically. But do we know why all this is happening right now?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation that power is shifting in the White House and that Steve Bannon, a populist, is on the decline and that the influence of the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is on the rise. And I think Kushner's views are aligned with Cohen's views. They're both more centrist. And for the most part, I think the changes we're seeing from the president reflect a more centrist kind of conventional view. It may be a sign that Trump feels his populist ideas are also not playing well outside his base, and he may want to try to boost his approval ratings so he can get some things done.
Although I guess if he can change the policies this quickly, he could always change them back. So we'll have to keep an eye on what happens at the White House. John Idsty, NPR economics correspondent. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
What do the president's policy reversals yesterday have to do with the apparent sidelining of chief strategist Steve Bannon? Philip Rucker is White House bureau chief at the Washington Post. He's on his cell phone outside the White House. And Philip, this may be palace intrigue to some, you know, fun, but it can seriously affect policies.
Well, that's a really good point. What we've seen in the last couple of weeks, and in particular with the news yesterday, is President Trump moving towards the middle, becoming less the bombastic, confrontational, blow-up Washington outsider and more of a dealmaker who's here to try to get things done and be a little more pragmatic and try to show that he can govern. And that's the influence of people like Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who is also a senior advisor in the White House and I would say arguably the most powerful aide in the White House right now.
Well, as you say, now those two camps, the Jared Kushner camp and the Steve Bannon camp, have devolved into opposing firing squads, is how the Washington Post puts it, firing at each other. But what are you hearing from people still in the Bannon camp? I'm thinking of Laura Ingraham, the talk show host sent an email.
Yeah, so, you know, the Bannon supporters make a strong case that he is the representative of the Trump movement inside the White House. What they mean by that is he's really the person trying to pull Trump towards his nationalist base to talk about that conservative populism. The problem, however, is that Bannon's standing has been severely diminished in the last few weeks, in part because he's been openly feuding with Jared Kushner, as well as, by the way, Jared's wife, Ivanka Trump, who is the president's daughter and another very influential, if informal, advisor at the White House.
We'll talk more about the divide and who's on each side. And again, you know, we have seen White Houses struggle with this before. I'm thinking of the Reagan years when Don Regan was the White House strategist, the president's strategist. He and First Lady Nancy Reagan were openly feuding at a certain point. But tell us more about this divide and if you think it's, you know, different from others that we've seen, because you've got people on Bannon's side calling people on the other side, the Kushner side, openly calling them Democrats, which, you know, a huge insult.
That's right. And what we see here is really a divide between nationalism and globalism. The Bannon side is fiercely nationalist. These are the architects of the America First ideology that President Trump laid out in his inaugural address. And what we've seen is a rising influence of the so-called globalists. These are people led by Jared Kushner, thinking about sort of pragmatism and business interests. Many of them are from New York. Other figures include Gary Cohn, who formerly was the head of Goldman Sachs, the major bank in New York, who now is the director of the National Economic Council, and he is ascendant. Gary Cohn is ascendant within the White House, and he's trying to steer the president towards a more centrist point of view. Gary Cohn, it's worth pointing out, actually is a registered Democrat.
Where does this leave Rebecca Mercer, the daughter of Robert Mercer, who's the man whose money helped lubricate Donald Trump's way into the White House? She maneuvered to have Steve Bannon come onto the campaign from her company. She has a data mining company. And they saw him as their conduit to the Oval Office. What happens there?
That's exactly right. There's perhaps no political donor more influential in the Trump campaign than Rebecca Mercer. Sources are telling us that she has become increasingly alarmed by Bannon's declining, fading standing. And so, you know, Bannon's fading fortunes are impacting not just the Mercer family, but a vast sort of infrastructure of right-wing nationalism and of sort of the anti-establishment conservative forces that are trying to influence the president.
And again, Philip Rucker, this is important because, as you say, it's, you know, which side wins and which direction does the country go in. Columnist Charles Krauthammer said last night on Fox News he thinks Bannon will stay in a limited role in the White House because you keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Your thoughts on what's going to happen here?
I think that might be right. There's no indication as of now that Bannon is heading towards the exits. But that doesn't mean he's going to remain the powerful figure that we've seen him as. Trump just isn't listening to him as much as people like Kushner and Gary Cohn. And it's noteworthy that in his interview yesterday with the Wall Street Journal, President Trump said of Steve Bannon, quote, he's just a guy who works for me. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement.
Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Philip, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Some of you might recognize Mozart, but did you know that's the phrase that started a beautiful relationship between the composer and a starling? As Mozart wrote in his notebook, one day he came across the bird in a shop, whistling the theme from the Allegretto to his Piano Concerto No. 17 in G major, which Mozart had just written and barely performed. How could the bird know it? Mozart jotted down his own version and the starling's, which, except for a sharp or two, was the same. Mozart's comment, Das war schön, that was wonderful, as he bought the bird and brought it home. Okay, that's one version of the story, and we're sticking with it. Author and naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt goes much further. She took in a starling, named it Carmen, named Mozart's star, and tried to answer the question, how could this most beloved of composers have found a muse in one of the most reviled of birds? Ever since they were brought here from England in the late 1800s for a stunt, people have tried to kill starlings. They've so multiplied. The book is Mozart's Starling. Lyanda joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Hi.
Hi, Robin.
What a great idea and a great read, although when your husband is balanced on a ladder precariously trying to take this little bird from a nest, it might not have seemed like a good idea. But start with, we've spoken about this on the program, why are starlings so reviled?
They are a non-native and invasive species, and they are smart, they're adaptable, they're clever, they're robust, they're aggressive, and so they've been able to take over just about every place that they attempt.
Well, they eat animal feed, they kick other birds out of nesting places. They're considered a pest, more than a pest.
Exactly. They are considered more than a pest. People look out their windows and see them behaving badly to the nicer little birds in their neighborhood. And so even people who don't know the science or the agricultural end of it know enough about starlings to hate them.
But they also can mimic like a parrot, as you
yes.
found out. So first of all, Mozart's starling. This bird went on and became such a companion, such a delight to Mozart, which isn't unusual back in the day. People carried their birds around in cages like boomboxes.
Yeah, they did. People had little tiny cages in their houses, not usually starlings, maybe a more melodious bird like a canary. They would carry it around and it would be the radio in the house.
Oh, just a lovely image. So you bring Carmen in to your home. First of all, you're a birder, you're an ornithologist. I mean, you know your birds. But this little furry ball, as it starts to grow, what was happening with your relationship with Carmen?
One of the things I didn't realize when we adopted Carmen is how friendly she would be. She just wants to be with us all the time. So we allow her as much free flight as she can possibly have and still be safe. And when she's out of her aviary, she just doesn't want to be with us. She wants to be on our shoulder, on our head, sharing our plates, sharing our beverages. You know, she just wants to be involved in everything. So the writing of this book literally took twice as long as it would have because it was written with her on my shoulder.
Well, because she's a social being, but she's also, as you write, starlings are, you know, one of the few birds that is a mimic. And first of all, she's talking, chatting all the time. Let's listen to a little of Carmen vocalizing.
The first vocalization you heard there was her saying her name, Hi Carmen.
Wait, let's hear it again.
Okay, let's hear it again.
Okay. Okay. Because she's mimicking what your family said to her.
Right. So that's the most amazing thing. So the first word that she learned to say was hi. And the second word was honey and Carmen, the second and third words. She says hi, honey, and hi, Carmen, because that's the first thing we say to her when we approach her aviary. Mm. One of the things that has been most surprising is that her mimicry is not random. When I come down in the morning, I tiptoe down. I'm the first one up. And I walk up to her cage. She doesn't meow like the cat, or she doesn't make the coffee grinder noise or the microwave beep, which are all things that she's capable of doing very well. The first thing she says is what she knows I'm about to say, which is, hi, Carmen. And I say, hi, Carmen. And then the cat comes downstairs. And when Carmen sees the cat, she says, meow.
Actually, I think we have some of that sound. Let's listen. So she knows who makes which sound.
She knows who makes which sound and when they're going to make it.
Well, look, okay. So here you're on this journey of discovery with this little feathered thing. We know that Mozart had a bird. What does it tell you about what that relationship might have been?
Finding out that they are so participatory in the household made me think of someone like Mozart, who was an expert himself at mimicry. He could mimic any operatic style. He liked to do mimics of other people at parties. He would mimic the emperor for fun. And he could imitate in his writing any musical style. So he had to have so much fun having a bird that was almost as gifted a mimic as he was in the house, or vice versa.
Well, you write both were incapable of being still and quiet in a world so full of sound. We know that about Mozart.
Right.
Both share the impulse to make wild, original, constant music. And I want to hear one piece of Mozart's music, because you think that it actually might have been influenced more by his bird than people realize. It is Mozart's musical joke. Let's just listen to a little. It's performed by Gunther Schuller and the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Now, some people turn up their noses at this piece. It's like, it's crazy. It's wacky. You say what?
In 1990, an ethologist, Meredith West at Indiana, an animal behavior researcher, she had heard about Mozart's starling. And she listened to this piece of Mozart and thought, oh, my gosh, I don't think it's that crazy. I think it sounds a lot like a starling. This piece was mimicking back the fractured phrases that starlings make when they vocalize, the way that they will just pick out little bits of things here and there and toss them in unexpectedly alongside different vocalizations that they don't seem to go very well with to our ear, but they must like for some reason.
Well, and that makes perfect sense to me, because as you tell us, Mozart didn't even attend his own father's funeral when his father died. But 2 months later, when his starling died, he held a funeral and wrote an elegy. He was broken up as anyone. I mean, now that you've had this living creature on your head, you understand that.
Absolutely. Commentators on Mozart, when they hear just the little bit that, you know, Mozart didn't attend his father's funeral, but he had this elegant formal funeral when his starling died, they say that it was just, you know, a joke, that it was just his eccentricity or absurdity. When I read that, the only thing I can think is, having lived with a starling, I know that there was more to it for Mozart than that. He was brokenhearted at the loss of his little mischievous friend and pet, especially so soon after the loss of his father. And surely this funeral did appeal to Mozart's sense of the absurd. I think it also might have relieved some of the conflict that he felt in not being able to attend his father's funeral in Salzburg.
Well, and he also might have been influenced elsewhere in his work. The Birdcatcher from Mozart's opera The Magic Flute may have been inspired by a starling. Let's just listen to a little of The Magic Flute, where you can hear bird-like sounds. Landolin Haupt, there's so much more here. If someone decides to take in a starling, it's a lot of work. They need baths every day. They take sun baths as well, where they fall into a torpor-like state. But after all of this and all the time you spent realizing that Mozart's starling was a muse, Carmen, your starling, does not really like, well, what does she like, bluegrass?
this is such a disappointment. She doesn't like Mozart at all. And she comes to life when other music is playing. She loves Bach. She loves bluegrass. And when we were playing her favorite band, Green Sky Bluegrass, actually, she just perks up as she starts singing and she starts chattering. And she gives her happy singing sounds.
Let's listen to a little of her singing with some bluegrass. Carmen, rocking out. Which brings us to why birds sing. You spent a lot of time, I mean, this book goes to Noam Chomsky and, you know, several PhDs who have tried to answer that question. It ranges from as a mating call to pure bliss. Talk about just this sense that you have of this universal sound that is this orchestra that's right outside our doors and we often don't notice it.
What I've seen living with Carmen and paying much more attention to all of the sounds in nature is that it's far more deep, far more participatory than we can reduce to just having to do with mating. And one of the ways I know that is that Carmen, as a songbird, she's not really supposed to be that vocal as a female, but Carmen, as a female, sings a lot, and she sings year-round. And I write in the book that when I was coming to the end, I had my writing studio window open just a little bit because Carmen was there and I didn't want her to get out. And I was listening to Mozart, and outside there's an orange crowned warbler singing. And I thought, who am I to decide which one of these is music and which one isn't?
Or in other words, it may not be that the starling heard Mozart's theme, but the composers are, subconsciously or not, hearing birds. It's the birds who are providing the music, not the other way around. That's Leandelin Haupt. She writes about Mozart's pet starling and her own, Carmen, in the new book, Mozart's Starling. It is just wonderful. Leanda, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Oh, and Leanda says, don't try this at home. Yes, starlings are an invasive species, but keeping one is illegal in most states.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Here and Now, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. The survey will be very helpful to us, so thanks. The passenger who was dragged off that United flight on Sunday, David Dow, has been discharged from a hospital. At a news conference today, one of Dow's lawyers, Thomas Demetrio, said that Dow suffered a serious concussion from what took place.
I can also tell you that he had a serious broken nose, injury to the sinuses, and he is going to be undergoing shortly reconstructive surgery.
Dow's daughter, Crystal Pepper, said that the events on that plane should never have happened.
We were horrified and shocked and sickened to learn what had happened to him and to see what had happened to him. We hope that in the future, nothing like this happens again.
Dow's lawyer said he will likely file a lawsuit. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first, what do we know about the lawsuit that may be coming?
Yeah, so Dow's lawyer says that they're probably going to sue United and the city of Chicago, which employs the airport police officers who were the ones who actually dragged Dow off of that United Airlines plane operated by Republic Airlines, interestingly enough. They've also filed an emergency motion to make sure that the airline and the airport hang on to surveillance footage, incident reports, any other data that might be pertinent to the case.
Now, there has been a lot of reaction to what's happened from China. It was originally thought by some that Dow was from China. Today, as we met him and members of his family and the lawyer, we learned that that is not the case. He's from Vietnam.
Yeah. Dow's daughter says that her father emigrated from Vietnam in the 1970s, that he has no connection to China. His lawyer said that that experience of being dragged off the plane was worse for Dow than his experience fleeing Vietnam by boat when right. Saigon fell. But the lawyer said that he did not think that race played a role in this.
What have we heard from United?
Well, they just released a statement saying that they continue to express an apology for what happened, saying that they're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. The CEO says that United is going to review crew movement. You know, it was they were trying to get passengers off that plane so that they could get a crew
right.
to another place so that they wouldn't inconvenience other passengers by canceling a flight the next day. So they're going to look at that, how they handle oversold situations, and that they're also reviewing their relationships with airport and local law enforcement. But they do say that United will not ask law enforcement to take people off of planes anymore.
It's amazing that it takes them so many tries to get to make that their official statement about this, because in the beginning, they were calling the passenger belligerent, and now they're really just apologizing as much as they can.
Yeah, it took a couple of days for the first apology, something that Dow says that he accepts, but through his lawyer, but that he feels was insincere. But I think this is partly less about crisis management and the fact that companies now realize that, you know, with every person with a cell phone, you can't just, you know, in the end, say, call security, because then you lose control of the situation.
The whole thing will be on tape and out there on the internet for everyone to see.
Right. And so that backstop, calling security, that's something that companies need to reevaluate. They need to train their employees to use discretion and not just follow the systems and the orders that the computers tell them to do.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thanks.
You got it.
Millions of Americans suffer from opioid addiction. The ongoing epidemic claims tens of thousands of lives every year, overdoses largely attributed to prescription pills and heroin. And although the sheer numbers of today are more than at any other time on record, the opioid crisis is far from new. So for a look back at that history, let's go to Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Nathan, Joanne, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
So this story of addiction goes by many names throughout U.S. history. Take us to the early days of the country when the use of opium, the dried condensed juice of the poppy plant, started to become more common. What was going on?
So looking back to early America, opium was seen for a long time as a kind of wonder drug. Because, you know, in that time period when medicine was relatively primitive, and there were certainly any number of ways in which people were not only sick but had pain, serious pain. And opium was magical because it was a pain killer. And so doctors pretty much prescribed it for anything and everything, for aches and pains and stomach trouble and fevers and anything else. They would either give opium or some sort of tincture with opium and something else. But opium was very widely prescribed. They weren't thinking about opium, although they noticed that it tended to be, or it seemed to be for some people, habit forming. The idea of addiction or that someone was an addict was not in the thinking of that period. And at that point, it really was a personal issue. They linked it with alcohol and alcohol. They also didn't say alcoholism, but alcohol and opium were both things that people seemed to have a compulsion towards or a habit about. And so there were people trying to help people break that kind of habit, but it was very much on a personal scale.
And the most common users in the early days were Continental and British soldiers treated on the battlefield. But what about when we get to the Civil War? How did things change?
Mm-hmm. Well, right. So the Civil War period obviously is a period of enormous pain of all kinds, and particularly morphine, which comes about really in the early 19th century. That becomes a real drug of choice during the Civil War and after the Civil War, and is widely, widely used. And obviously, although it's seen as an alternative to opium, maybe a better alternative to opium, it's as much, if not more, addictive and becomes an enormous problem.
And I noticed that white women made up a large number of users after the Civil War. What was driving that?
Well, you have to understand that the medical profession was largely still segregated at this period. So if you go to the South or even parts, you know, North, you find a number of physicians who were only making these kinds of painkillers available to whites, and particularly to white women. You have a number of corners of the South where some two-thirds of those who we would call addicts today are white women. And a large part of what's driving that, of course, are difficulties with childbirth, right? All kinds of uteral complications that that really do require pretty acute pain medication. The other thing that was kind of connected to this, of course, was the use of opiums in places like Chinatown in San Francisco or Chinatown in New York. And there was a very real concern among a number of critics and observers that white women would also be descending into these opium dens and possibly fall prey to any manner of kind of oriental predation, to use that language, that might come from that period. So the problem of white women and the use of this particular drug was certainly sharp in the late 19th century.
They're blaming the Chinese immigrants for the problem. A lot of people, you're saying, just the way that these days we hear even President Trump blaming Mexicans for the drug problems.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of local and state laws that were unfurled in the 1870s and 1880s, particularly, again, like San Francisco had a very sharp ordinance curtailing opium use in Chinatown. The state of California eventually adopted a statewide policy. But by the time you got to the 19-teens, you know, about 1915 or so, you had a number of states that effectively tried to target these kinds of underground uses. And it's largely a state and local issue. The actual name of the Opium Exclusion Act, 1909, is eerily reminiscent of the Chinese Exclusion Act, right?
Wow. And the
idea was to, if you can control the influx of Chinese or control the influx of opium, you can basically make sure that these kinds of difficulties effectively don't cross the color line. But Jeremy, there's an important kind of thread running through all of this, which is that as regulation changes, and the drug's form changes, the meaning of use and abuse also changes, as does the nature of government response. So the Opium Act of 1909 actually creates a huge spike in the price of opium, I mean, particularly opium smoking. So it requires other kinds of underground versions to basically take its place, changing the way, of course, then the drug is then enforced.
Now, we've been talking about opium. In 1898, we had the invention of heroin right before World War I. What happened there?
So the use of heroin was first popularized by Bayer, which added it to its pills in 1898. A German engineer found a way to basically pull this one strain out of opium, diacetylmorphine, as a strain which ultimately becomes heroin. And that becomes part of what then is the street drug used in place of opium. And what's remarkable about the kind of creation of this cheaper form is it then creates all kinds of mischief in the ways in which bureaucrats talk about it. So in the 1930s, you obviously have prohibition that ends in 1933, but there's still a ramping up of the policing of heroin. And so it's thought that if you can find a way to expand what the dangers of heroin might be by including, say, marijuana as a gateway drug, then you can have a much larger kind of enforcement. And there's one particular official, Harry Anslinger, who basically runs the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, who's very adamant about not only talking about the dangers of marijuana and opium, but then also racializing the drug. So the first time you really do begin to see labels about the breakdown of the black family or the targeting of kind of wayward whites at a federal level begins really in the 1930s and the dangers of heroin as a kind of drug of last resort for those who might begin with marijuana or other lesser drugs.
But let me point out a broader pattern here that based on what Nathan was just saying and links back to what I was just saying, and that is the overall pattern really is that someone comes up with what appears to be some new wonder drug or wonder something that begins to be prescribed by doctors
right. More
and more widely, possibly even overprescribed, becomes widespread, moves beyond that realm. Then, of course, it does bring in all of these questions, not just about what to do for the people who are addicted, but then what do you do? How do you enforce? How do you pinpoint? What's the line? I mean, the other interesting thing about opioids generally, and I think just drugs generally, is that I think certainly many people have a sense that there's a strong dividing line between, on the one hand, medical drugs and then on the other hand, you know,
right. Drugs,
you know, that they're right. Bad things and good things. And the fact of the matter is that the opioid story shows you the very blurry middle ground between the two and that you can't really draw that line. It's a matter of things shifting over time.
Is the history of drug use and addiction in the United States dramatically different than it is in other countries? I mean, we know now that doctors in this country prescribe far more opioids than doctors in other countries.
Right. So, you know, there was an effort in Portugal, for instance, to kind of legalize, you know, narcotics effectively. And they saw some pretty remarkable consequences. This is in the early 2000s, where you saw reductions in HIV/AIDS transmission. You saw reductions, obviously, in incarceration. But one of the things about the Portugal case that doesn't necessarily hold in the U.S. case, particularly around the legalization debate, is that since the 1970s, there's been a pretty consistent expansion of other kinds of social services that could take the place of, say, law enforcement in a variety of different corners, right? So in this country, as much as there are debates about legalization in certain states like Colorado or Alaska, or even about taking, you know, the question of oxycodone and its abuse and making it more of a medical issue and not criminalizing, you know, opioids in the way that they once were, the difficulty, of course, is that what kinds of other supports are in place. It's no secret that the underground economy of the drug trade basically took the place of certain kinds of gainful employment in communities that suffered under deindustrialization, right? Or the difficulty of keeping drugs out of school has a lot to do with other forms of segregation, white flight, and so forth. So any debate that happens in this country around drug policy needs to also be a conversation about other kinds of social services and the role of the state more generally, not just in terms of enforcing drug policy, but providing other kinds of services to communities that might be going through other kinds of pain.
And I think in many ways, although there's a different combination of factors making it a problem in earlier America still, as you just pointed out, it's a whole bundle of things. And it's easy to look at one section of that problem and not see all the problems. I also have to add, Nathan, you pulled Portugal out of there. I'm very impressed.
That is
Nathan.
The first Portugal reference on the show this week. So
beautiful.
You win
wow.
a prize. Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman, they are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks
Jeremy.
For having us.
Our next story begins with an open wound, both physical and emotional, but it ends with a bittersweet healing. Erica Lance from Here and Now contributor WBUR has the story.
When Dr. Shiva Kayambashi met Joe Nasworthy, Joe was on his stomach.
He was lying prone on his belly because he had a huge wound that almost encompassed the entirety of his back.
Dr. K, as she's commonly known, is a family physician at San Francisco General Hospital, a county hospital for underserved and often uninsured patients. Joe had just had several huge malignant melanomas excised from his back. The skin cancer spots had gotten so big because he couldn't see them, and because he didn't have anyone in his life who would have noticed them.
As soon as I crouched down and introduced myself, he just, in a way that I didn't expect, lit up as though he knew me and smiled. Hi, Dr. Kayambashi. I was very surprised and taken aback by that kind energy about him.
Dr. K was struck by the fact that Joe never complained about being sick, maybe because he'd been through worse.
He really had a lot of hard things happen to him. My guess is he had been homeless off and on, at least. And he made choices that he didn't feel proud of.
Joe had suffered from chronic depression. Now he quickly became a beloved figure around Ward 4A. He'd help patients cut their food, push people in wheelchairs. And because Joe had once been a musician, he'd sometimes sit in front of the nurse's station and play his guitar.
There would be other patients who would actually come out and just sit there and listen and close their eyes and just be taken away by it. There was such a gentleness to his nature. And I told him that a lot. I remember, you know, Joe, you are, how is it that you're such a kind soul? And, you know, he would blush. It was less than a year, but we were his family.
By the end of the year, Joe's cancer had spread, and Dr. K had to tell him he didn't have long to live. He was calm about it, but said one thing that surprised her.
I remember that he said, you know, the only thing I wish for was, would have been to see my daughter.
Apparently, Joe had an estranged daughter. She'd been born with heroin in her system and was put into foster care as a baby. Then she was adopted, and father and daughter lost contact.
He told me he really loved her.
To the staff of Ward 4A, the mission was obvious. Find his daughter, Natasha Ambrose. Natasha remembers the phone call from Dr. K, saying her biological father was dying.
It was a blend of emotions. It was shocking. It was a little shocking. And then went into, oh my gosh, okay, let me get the day off. I'll be down as soon as I can.
Natasha, in her mid-30s by then, with a family of her own, drove 6 hours to the hospital. It had been 2 decades since she'd seen Joe, but that day they talked for hours.
They allowed me to sleep in the room with him that night and told me that they were breaking the rules. It was important to them, for his sake, that I be there.
Joe's health improved in the weeks after Natasha's visit. The two would talk by phone, and she arranged for Joe to enter hospice near her home. He was looking forward to meeting his infant grandson.
And then I got another call.
Joe had taken a sudden turn. Natasha needed to fly right away if she wanted to say goodbye. But Dr. K knew that finding travel funds would be a challenge. So the hospital staff pooled enough money to fly Natasha and her son to San Francisco.
He was in a nonverbal state by that point, and I remember each of the nurses and me at varying times dropping into his room and saying, Joe, Natasha's on her way, and try to hang on.
By the time Natasha and her son got there, Joe was pretty out of it.
Put Mason on his lap and said, hey, here's your grandson.
While the staff took turns watching the baby, Natasha sang to her dying dad.
Lay me down, my dear brother. Lay me
they both down loved music, after all.
When I checked in on her, I think I perceived tears coming from his eyes or tears filling in his eyes. And I saw tears, of course, from her.
I love you.
After a few hours, Joe took his last breath. Natasha was sitting next to him.
Good night. Good night. My last words to him were, it was disappointing to not have known you. As I was growing up, but I'm glad to be here now. And that's when I pulled down his beanie and kissed him on the cheek. It was truth.
The next day, the staff invited Natasha back to Ward 4A for a memorial. 20 staff members sat in a circle and told stories about Joe.
They totally rearranged my perception of who my father was. Here I was thinking, you know, he was a derelict alcoholic or drug abuser, but he was so much more.
For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lantz.